This is Season 5, Episode 2, entitled Shoa, 6 Million Crucifixions. In the Hebrew language, the word Shoa literally means complete destruction, absolute annihilation, desolation of souls, the absolute worst thing that could happen to the heart of the Jews. This is episode 2 of season 5, and it is entitled Shoa, 6 Million Crucifixions. After the French Revolution in 1799, Jews were emancipated in France after 300 years of being confined to ghettos under papal rule. Ever since the Emperor Constantine, Jews were not allowed to proselytize. Therefore, the Jewish religion could only expand through procreation with other Jews. Over time, this basically turned a religion into a race of people built on Judaism and its practices. As the emancipation grew in other countries through Europe, there were still some forces that fought to keep things exactly how they were. A segregation between the atheist devils and white European Christians. After the year 1815, the Holy Alliance got precisely what they wanted in Germany, as well as Austria and Italy. However, after the emancipation, this newfound freedom for Jews actually began to bring significant contributions to science, mathematics, and the arts, as well as a number of Nobel Prize winners such as Einstein and Marx. When the walls of the ghettos came down, the many Christians were not quite prepared for this, as their view of the Jews was the same as the devil, the killers of Christ. The view of the Jew was becoming less religious and more about a race of people. Jews were the blame for all existing social and political problems and were profiled as inferior to the Aryan race, the perfect and most pure race of white European people. Now, of course, politicians were quick to use this as a powerful tool, in fact. In Germany, the Jews began to rise up in society and were able to give their children a higher education, where the middle-class groups were struggling by industrialization and could not afford to put their offspring through better schools. After just a few decades, Jews became lawyers, doctors, scientists, bankers, moneylenders. The Jews became more visible as the bourgeoisie of white European society. But by 1874 through 1879 marked Europe's worst economic crisis, which caused a rise of National Socialism. The Jews became once again the scapegoat, and the term was coined, "The Jews are our misfortune." Of the many conflicts in 1830, 1838, and even 1871, the Jews were portrayed as the ones responsible for any and all problems that developed from economic issues to poor agriculture, to the change of climate, to sociological problems. In the eyes of the white European Christians living in the 19th century, yes, the Jews must be to blame for this curse on our people and on our land. This was no longer about religious differences, people, or the fact that they refused to worship Jesus. Rather than this was more about a race of people who were not like them. They looked different, wore different clothes, liked different kinds of food, and maybe even talked a little bit different than them. They were a misfortune to the hard-working class of white European Christians, the white Christian nation, And this created an insurmountable amount of stress sociologically between Christians and Jews in the 19th century. His name was Giovanni Maria Mazzai Ferreri. He was born on May 13, 1792. He was also Pope Pius IX, who reigned the Holy Roman Catholic Church and the Empire through the Vatican and all the papal territories from 1846 to 1878. And incidentally, he was the 19th century father of anti-Semitism, literally the leader of Jewish hatred. Now, although he was responsible for having the walls of the ghettos in Rome to be torn down along with the four sermons, his tolerant attitude towards the Jews was, unfortunately, short-lived. Because in 1848, there was a political power struggle where the Sardinian House of Savoy took control of the streets, which forced the Pope to flee for safety. Now, the House of Savoy was basically a royal dynasty that was established in the year 1003 in the historical Savoy region. And through gradual expansion, the family grew in power, from ruling a small alpine country northwest of Italy to absolute rule of the Kingdom of Sicily from 1713 to 1720, when they were handed the island of Sardinia, over which they would exercise direct rule from then onward. They once again attempted to take total control. But when Pope Pius IX returned and power was finally restored, he scapegoated the Jews as well as any other kind of liberal thinker. Revolutionaries, they were persecuted, and he promulgated violent regulations against the Jews. He went as far as restoring the old restrictions and imprisoning the Jews once again back into the ghettos. In 1864, he compiled what's called the Syllabus of Errors. It's a list of what he thought to be 80 mistakes of theology, philosophy, and politics. And this was his attack on modernism. In this proclamation, he denounced freedom of religion and separation of church and state, as well as control of public schools. He said that the war was a conspiracy of secrets with the Masons among them, fatefully implicating the Jews as hidden enemies of the church. He says in this syllabus, "It is from them that the synagogues of Satan, which gathers its troops against the Church of Christ, takes its strength. And these wicked groups think that they have already become masters of the world. They seek nothing less than to subject the Church of God to the most cruel servitude, and if possible, make it disappear completely from the earth." Now, if you've been listening to this show and you're a fan and you've been paying attention, you picked up right away on where the allusion to the synagogues of Satan actually comes from. It comes from a couple different places. First mentioned and ignited by Josephus Flavius, right? The Roman historian who writes in the year 76 or so after the Jewish-Roman Wars. And in the words of the Jews, he refers to that wicked generation of Jews who were the Zealots. They were the rebels that were rebelling against Roman occupation and ultimately had their city and their temple destroyed by Vespasian and his son Titus. And in the words of the Jews, because of this, Josephus refers to them the wicked generation, demons, devils. And that's coming from a devout Jew who obviously did not support this rebellious activity. But now sometime around the late 70s, going into the early 80s, we get some New Testament authors who start referring to the demons, but with parallels to these rebellious Jews. And then finally, we get what is called the Book of Revelation that was composed by an unknown author, using the pseudonym John, as in potentially the Apostle John for apostolic authority, written sometime around the end of the second century, where Jewish places of worship are twice referenced by this author. And the dating of this is confirmed because of the last Jewish-Roman war that took place in the year 135 under Simon Bar Kokhba. And obviously, this author is writing in response to that, as the continued efforts of the Jewish revolt to remove Romans from Judea. Now, the Pope's mention of it would have a profound influence in the decades to come, with the association of the Jews to that of devils. And this is in the book of Revelation, chapter 2, verse 9, and chapter 3, verse 9, in the letters to the early Christians in Smyrna and Philadelphia. I will quote these two verses. I know thy works, and thy tribulations and poverty, but thou art rich, and I know the blasphemy of them, which I say they are Jews, and are not, but are the synagogues of Satan. And behold, I will make them the synagogues of Satan, which say they are Jews, and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. Now, end quote. Now, shortly after the Italian forces freed the Jews from the ghettos in 1871, Pope Pius IX declared that by rejecting Christianity, Jews had become dogs, and that we have dogs today in Rome. And unfortunately, we have too many dogs. We hear them barking in the streets and going around molesting people everywhere, he says to his congregations and to all of his bishops and to all of his pastors. We actually have a second pious pope in Catholic history, Pope Pius XI, or the 11th. His name was Achille Ratti. He was also a very heavy, influential anti-Semite as well, along an entire line of anti-Semitic popes. Now, when Pope Benedict XV sent him to Poland in 1918 to actually improve the situation with the Jews, he instead did everything possible to impede upon them. In fact, he reported back to the Vatican that the Jews are actually very dangerous and were involved in contraband, fraud, and usury. He also stated that they were evil and had a strong influence over the people there. And he also confided in Mussolini in 1932 that he believed that the Jews were a threat, a vital threat to white European Christian society. Angels and demons simply cannot coexist. Pope Pius XI, Achille Ratti, would sign the Reichskonkordat, which was basically a diplomatic agreement that was between the Vatican and Nazi Germany, making the Vatican the head supreme, head office of the Catholic Church of Christianity, the first foreign power to formally acknowledge the Third Reich. This agreement was intended to protect the Church's interest in Germany, which was ultimately beneficial to Adolf Hitler, the leader of the Nazi movement. Eugenio Maria Giuseppe Giovanni Pacelli. He was the Pope over the Catholic Church from the Vatican State from 1939 to 1958. He was Pope Pius XII and the Vatican Secretary of State. Well, he had the misfortune to rise to power as Pope during the darkest period in all of human history, the Second World War. No other Pope had to deal with the simultaneous calamities of communism, world war, genocide. It was unfortunate, however, that his priority was with confronting the dangers of communism instead of preventing the extermination of 6 million Jews. As Pope, he held three official positions. He was the head of his church and in direct communication with bishops everywhere, literally hundreds of them. He was the chief of the state of the Vatican, and he was also the bishop of Rome. So in theory, he could influence 400 million Catholics and Christians. He also believed that communism posed a threat to Christianity, not Nazism. In fact, one of his first actions as Pope was to lift the ban on anti-communism and an anti-Semitic French movement, Action Française. By doing so, he initiated a policy which would sacrifice the lives of Jews if it meant advancing the fight against communism. even as the evil nature of Nazism became clear to Pius XII. He continued to conceive of it as a lesser of two evils. When Berlin's bishop, Pressling, begged Pope XII to speak out against the murder of innocent Jews, the Pope replied to him that the most pressing issue was maintaining the Church's unity and the trust of Catholics on either side of the conflict. He also wrote to Pressling that he felt that he had to do whatever was necessary, including sacrificing his moral standing to maintain the safety of Rome. For the Pope, the lives of the millions of Jewish men, women, and children were less important than the priceless treasures in the Vatican and what they represented to millions of Catholics all around the world. Even after the war had ended, Pope Pius XII took steps that were detrimental to the surviving Jews and to the memory of those who had been exterminated by the German death squads, supported by the Catholic Church. He had ample opportunity, guys, to address the issue of Christian-Jewish relations. Yet he chose not to only ignore the issue of anti-Semitism, but also to disapprove of Catholic efforts to reconcile with the Jews. He also helped provide a shelter and aid, as well as help escape Nazi war criminals to Argentina and Brazil. Now, these modern-day bigots, they were brought up on beliefs just like that of Pope Benedict VIII, who blamed the Jews for a hurricane and an earthquake, and then ultimately had them executed in the year 1021. This type of thinking could explain the rationality behind more modern problems like social and economic upheavals and revolution, using what they had learned. Now, when Hitler joined the political scene after the Great War, Germany was in an enormous economical collapse due to the Treaty of Versailles, the treaty that required Germany to disarm and make territorial concessions and pay reparations to countries that were affected by the war. Some 132 billion gold marks, to be exact, or then 31.4 billion U.S. dollars, or 6.6 billion pounds, roughly equivalent to $442 billion today, or 281 billion pounds in 2022. This sent Germany into such a recession that their money had less value than a Monopoly game. Hitler found that the minds of the German citizens were ready and prepared to accept the message that explained Germany's defeat to the war and every other problem on the Jew. This was so easy to do, since Germans had heard from their parents, grandparents, teachers, their priests, that Jews were devils and responsible for everything that was terrible and loathsome. Many Germans grew up hearing the stories of how Jews were enemies of Christianity because they were responsible for killing Jesus Christ and turning their back on their own God, poisoning wells of Christian homes, responsible for the Black Plague, earthquakes, tsunamis, whatever, murdering young Christian boys for their blood libels in their rituals. Over time, these rumors turning into ideas would become ingrained in the minds of every German growing up in the 1920s and the 1930s. Then soon a barrage of anti-Semitic propaganda began to appear on street signs, storefront windows, street corners everywhere all throughout Europe. Anti-Semitic propaganda was on the cover of every German newspaper. If you were standing on a street corner waiting for a bus, you would hear the same message being spewed from speakers mounted to light posts, or even on the radio while having dinner in the evening. These messages of hate, based upon a mythological character invented to suppress radical Judaism in the first century, spread to hundreds of thousands of poor and starving Germans in the 1920s. the cult of personality. It's built, the idea is built around the idea of a heroic leader. It is especially popular in totalitarian regimes. In Nazi Germany, the cult of personality emphasized individual dedication and loyalty to the all-powerful leader, who exemplified the Aryan race. As the Führer, the leader of the Nazi Party, Adolf Hitler, used his charismatic and passionate speeches, accusing Jews for the loss of the war, and as a result, the economic crisis that developed after the war, to get the German people to accept his vision of the future. Eventually, these posters that we talked about in storefront windows, art would be used that would portray him, Adolf Hitler, as the benevolent leader for the entire nation. Posters were made that portrayed him kind of like the memes that you see today of Donald Trump as the Messiah, as the return of Jesus, carrying a machine gun, of course. And that's Trump, of course. Hundreds of thousands of German citizens are exposed to this propaganda, showing Hitler as the savior of their country, and would restore their life back to the way it was before the Jews ruined it. Yes, many believed in all sorts of superstitious stories, even in the 19th century, even in the 20th century, even in the 21st century. Scary, right? Germany's loss in World War I and the difficult provisions of the Treaty of Versailles provided the breeding ground for widespread hate and discontent among Germans. Until October 1918, the imperial government, the imperial German government, controlled all news media, radio, newspaper, you name it. Propaganda extolled the fighting capabilities of the individual soldiers and the country's victories over the Western Allies. Suddenly, the government announced an armistice, or a truce, if you would. In October of 1918, which in effect was a surrender. Between 1918 and 1923, Weimar Germany was plagued by severe internal crises. From both the left and the right came assassinations, anti-government propaganda, popular revolts. The already weakened war-damaged economy, it could not recover. Reparations and hyperinflation, well, it prevented reconstruction of the areas that were destroyed during war. The period between 1918 and 1923 is described by Professor Claudia Kunz, and I will begin a quote. "The trauma of surrender, economic hardship, and political revolution defined the real world in which most Germans lived. But emotionally, they lived in the aftermath of wartime glory. Images of brave soldiers and strong women, hymns to a national spirit, and appeals to sacrifice persisted even as reality left them behind. As Germans experienced hunger, fear of invasion, revolution, and economic disaster, they clung to dreams created by the wartime propaganda." End quote. Now, I'm actually looking at a poster from that 1918-1923 post-World War I propaganda. And basically, Adolf Hitler is on this huge white horse, this big, beautiful stallion. And he's in victory, but he's holding up a white flag. But underneath him and his horse is a massive pile of dead soldiers. But they're French, they're American, and they're British. And then standing around the outside of that, and there's actually an American flag you can see hidden in the pile of rubble of humans. And then there are German soldiers that are standing in victory, saluting him. That was the propaganda that was on those storefront windows and on street corners that we talked about. New political parties from both the right and the left would begin to evolve in all the chaos of this post-war Germany. The rightist being the Nazi Party, officially the National Socialist German Workers' Party, referred to by the acronym Nazi, began with less than 100 members, but it grew rapidly. The Nazi solution to Germany's problems was unification, getting everybody on board, on the same page. They emphasized a trinity, the individual, the people, and the nation, united together and led by a visionary leader, Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was born and raised as a Catholic, but soon became an atheist, who did not believe necessarily in God. But some historians say that he did, in fact, believe in the devil, or devils, evil powers. There are also many implications that he was a cultic leader as well, believing in a completely different God altogether. Now, Hitler, like most Christians, believed that many evils existed in different forms, like leprosy and pestilence, hunger and war, and they were also all the work of this devil, or these devils or demons or evil powers and evil forces, who also had helpers on earth that would be instruments of the devil. By the time he began his political career, he realized the importance of projecting an image of religiosity, as seen in his memoirs, Mein Kampf. In fact, I'll give you a quote from it. This is from Adolf Hitler. "I believe today that my conduct is in accordance with the will of the Almighty God. What we have to fight for is the freedom and the independence of the fatherland." End quote. Even in his public speeches, he made a point to make a connection between him, his work, and God. Sound familiar? As well as remark on the religious support for his fight against the Jews. Now, in a speech that he delivered in 1936, he said, "I believe today I am acting in the sense of the Almighty Creator. By warding off the Jews, I am fighting for the Lord's work." Now, this gave the Germans an understanding that Hitler was on a divine mission from God. Same as evangelical Christians today with respect to Colt 45. Now, as Hermann Göring said, "God gave the German people the Savior. We have faith that Hitler was sent to us by God in order to save Germany." Now, Hitler understood that to persuade the German people, he would need to appear religious and involved in the church and with deep connections to the Vatican, which he did through Pope Pius XII, XII. And fortunately for Hitler, the Pope was enamored by Hitler and even had people from the Third Reich on his team to serve at the Vatican as well as Berlin. As a result, systematic murdering of Europe's Jews had begun shortly after the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. And by the end of the year, widespread massacres had become well known among German colonizers, and millions of German soldiers serving on the Eastern Front, as well as the German population back home, listening to the radio, reading newspapers. As Stuart Hermann, who was the minister of the American Church, who was in Berlin until December 1941, well, he reported, "At the site of the Bayar massacre, more than 30,000 Jews were murdered by the end of September. Jewish men, women, and babies were lined up and machine gunned down by young men. All believed that they were doing the right thing." And then German soldiers would send home pictures of the people that they had just killed, like a postcard. They would take a picture, have it developed, fold it in half with a little note about the good deeds that they had just accomplished. Very, very sick. I'm actually looking at two right now that are on the essay on page 824. One picture shows a German soldier murdering a mother while holding her child. And this is a card that the soldier sent back home to his family and friends, boasting about the extermination and its success. Then the other postcard or picture is the same thing. A proud SS soldier sending a picture of how he executed a Jewish man in front of all of his friends and fellow SS before going into the pit, a huge pit of murdered dead bodies, murdered Jews. On September 18th, 1942, Monsignor Giovanni Battista Montini, who was the Vatican Undersecretary at the time and the future Pope Paul VI, well, he wrote, "The massacre of the Jews is reaching frightening proportions." Now, however, when later that month, the U.S. representative to the Vatican told the Pope that his silence was endangering him of his moral prestige. And the secretary responded on the Pope's behalf, stating, "It is impossible to verify rumors about crimes against the Jews." So the point is, the Vatican could have played a critical and significant role in at least slowing down the ongoing genocide, but chose to not get involved, as it was more important to protect Christianity and the Church, along with the beautiful treasures that were housed inside the Vatican. Then on August 19th, 1942, the men of the police battalion 101 embarked upon and entered the town, the Polish town of Lomazy. And they rapidly scoured the town, going in and out of homes and businesses. And they rounded up all the Jews that they could find. The soldiers, by gunpoint, forced the Jewish prisoners to the center of town. They shot and killed anyone that could not move on their own, such as the old or the sick. They would do this in their homes or wherever it was that they found them, many of them still lying in their beds, sitting on the sofa, or with their spouses at the dinner table or the breakfast table. Once the German soldiers finished gathering all the Jews who could walk on their own, they were led to a holding area near the woods. Some were given a shovel and instructed at gunpoint to go dig a massive pit, a grave, if you would, for those who were about to be executed. It's early in the morning at this point. Meanwhile, the German soldiers and the police officers of Battalion 101, they sat and had breakfast, as well as took shots of vodka while watching the Jewish prisoners digging their own grave. Once the pit was completed in a few hours, the German soldiers took the Jews on a death march into the woods, the ones that were waiting at the perimeter, still by the city. The younger men first, who could potentially put up a fight, then the women, then the children, and then the elderly who could walk on their own. They shot down any stragglers or those who would try to make a run for it into the woods. Once they got to the clearing, they could see that the young Jewish men who had been digging the large hole for hours, you could picture it in your mind, right? The pit was somewhere to right around 6, 8, 10 feet deep in certain places, 30 feet long to 50 feet long, maybe 10 to 15 feet wide. Basically the size of a large swimming pool, if you would. Everyone was instructed at gunpoint to remove their clothes. How humiliating. And hand over all of their valuables. Sliding rings off of their fingers. Wedding bands. A husband sliding his wedding ring off of his bride. Anything else with value. You can imagine family members standing together naked as they pulled off their wedding bands, earrings, sometimes with the aggressive help from an SS soldier. Just standing there looking at each other, I'm sure in tears, shaking, looking for help from anyone, even God. The Jews were lined up, and they were forced to enter this pit, one by one, basically jumping down from off the sides, down the 6, 8, 10 feet sections. as they filled in. Fathers handing their children down to their mother's arms. Soldiers began to get bored and made 15 to 20 go in at a time, while the German soldiers began to gun them down with their machine guns. They also fired a spread of bullets into those who were already in the pit. Some died as bodies fell in. Others would try to hide behind them or underneath the bodies. Others would hold the hands and the heads of the dead as they waited for their turn. As the pit filled with beaten, battered, shot up, abused naked bodies of these Jews, in literally massive pools of blood and brain matter, the Jews still standing outside of the pit were told to go in and lay down, face down on top of the others, so their backs are facing up towards the machine guns. The soldiers that were standing in the pit shot each one in the back of the head, spreading blood, brain fragments, pieces of bone everywhere. No matter how old, no matter how young. The exploding sound of a little girl's head from a soldier's rifle was just a job that had to be done. The following groups of Jewish people that were still being led into the woods, they had to see this as they entered the pit to lay down with the others. The soldiers at this point were also getting drunk from the vodka shots with their breakfast, and they actually started missing their shots and not killing them, grazing them. This left the pit with moaning and crying as subsequent groups arrived. By the end of the day, more than 1,700 Jewish men, women, and children had been murdered and left in that pit in the heat of the day. To make matters even worse, the pit was dug deep enough that water actually started to fill the pit, which allowed the bodies to begin to float. In the country of Slovakia is of particular interest to this podcast, because the president and many of the officials in the government during the war were actually Catholic priests. The priest of the Catholic Church was more than influential. They were political founders and leaders of the newly independent state. President Priest Tiso, who boasted of Slovakia's Catholic principles, preached in a holiday mass in August of 1942 as the first wave of Jews were being deported to death camps, and that it was a Christian act because Slovakia to free itself of its pests. When a rabbi asked a papal ambassador to intervene the deportation of innocent Jewish children, infants from Slovakia to Auschwitz, the ambassador said, and I begin quote, "There is no innocent blood of Jewish children in the world. All Jewish blood is guilty. You have to die. This is the punishment that is awaiting you because of that sin." End quote. This belief that the Jews deserve their fate as punishment for killing Christ was pervasive among the clergy. As Archbishop Kametko of Nitra said, and I'm going to begin another quote here, "They will slaughter all of you in the death camps, old, young, women, and children at once. It is the punishment that you deserve for the death of our Lord and Redeemer, Jesus Christ." End quote. Looking in contrast, in the American South, you know, when we consider black slaves that suffered immeasurably and horribly, yet they were never targeted for systematic extermination as an ethnic group, even though their white masters thought of them as subhuman and not much more than the beast of burden. The Germans went as far as and beyond because they felt that the Jews were guilty of monstrous crimes and were extremely dangerous, even to their souls. They exterminated Jews because they felt that they were defending themselves from what they perceived to be a demonic influence. A demonic influence on their Christian way of life. even Catholic and Protestant clergy, served in the German armed forces providing comfort to the soldiers, who were mass murderers. They were not innocent. These soldiers were not innocent. They needed to have Catholics and Protestants on the battlefield to help them at ease that they're doing the right thing to save their souls from these demons. In fact, over 1,000 priests looked after the spiritual needs of Germans who served on the killing squads, as well as working in the death camps. In these death camps, such as Auschwitz, the Germans would gas the Jews by tens of thousands a day. They would force them into large chambers, then to be gassed. The bodies would then be packed inside of ovens, as many as they could cram in there. And I've seen these firsthand. I've seen these firsthand on tour just a couple of years ago. I've seen the ovens that the bodies would be piled into. It's disgusting. While these tens of thousands of bodies had to wait to be burned, they would be stacked outside of the building, 6 feet high, 30 feet long. It's just disgusting. These military chaplains supported the killers by blessing and condoning their actions. The German soldiers, torturing innocent men, women, and children to their deaths, felt that they were serving a higher purpose. That purpose was vengeance for their Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. The perpetrators inflicted unspeakable pain and suffering on the Jewish people before killing them, because they were taking their own personal revenge for capitalism, communism, for the defeat of World War I, for unemployment, for economic depression, for taking the best jobs, for causing the Black Plague, for poisoning wells of Christian families, for killing Christian children for their blood libels. All of these false, and baseless accusations stem from a belief that the Jews were associated with the devil and the killing of Christ as portrayed through Christian literature for centuries. Now, towards the end of the war, the Vatican finally did come around and it did decide that it wanted to help out. Unfortunately, the Pope thought that it would be a great idea to, instead of helping the Jewish families who were affected by genocide, but instead set up rat lines or escape routes. This decision, of course, was for the Vatican's economical benefit with its relationship with Germany, to aid and abet the escape of wanted German war criminals. That is correct. You heard me right. The Pope and the Vatican were responsible for aiding and abetting the escape for wanted German Nazi war criminals instead of helping the families of genocide. The motivation for this criminal act was to create and support an army of freedom fighters for the upcoming fight against communism. Other factors were the conviction that the Nazi and fascist murderers that they were helping escape had not done anything wrong, that they were being unjustly persecuted by vindictive forces, and that it was simply a matter of Christian charity to ensure their safety. The Vatican helped German war criminals escape to South America and North America and wherever they could seek and find shelter. The Vatican also helped provide proper identification to allow these murderers to make their great escape. They also provided them funds, some seed money, in order to get them settled in Argentina, Brazil, wherever they found shelter. So instead of smuggling Jewish survivors into Palestine or Argentina, the Vatican chose to smuggle the world's most treacherous criminals with crimes against humanity to safety. The rat lines were funded by money that was plundered from Jewish homes, the Jewish victims. To this day, the Vatican still has not returned one damn cent of Jewish blood money to any of the victims' families. Some of the worst and most wanted Nazi war criminals passed through the Ratline network that included Walter Rauf in Milan, onto Bishop Hedel, and then Pius's best friend Archbishop Siri in Genoa, where they boarded ships heading off to South America. Now, namely, Argentina was the safe haven here for these war criminals, where the president supported the idea of anti-Semitism, as well as supported the idea of Nazism. His name was General Juan Perón. He was actually very instrumental in harboring these war criminals because he provided them with passports, all the proper documentation, all the proper identification to get them to safety. And here's a list of some of these escapees. Adolf Eichmann, who coordinated the annihilation of millions of Jews and responsible for their transportation to the death camps. Franz Strangl, a commander who murdered over a million Jews in two death camps, Sobibor and Treblinka. Kurt Kreisman, he was the commander who murdered tens of thousands of Jews in the Soviet Union. Walter Rauf, the developer of the gas vans that were used to kill hundreds of thousands of Jewish people in the fields before the gas chambers were invented. Klaus Barbie, a.k.a. the Butcher of Lyon, who was responsible for torturing and the death of countless Jewish people. Gustav Wagner, the commanding officer of the death camp Sobibor, where over 200,000 Jewish people were murdered in gas chambers. Alois Brunner, who was an officer in the Jewish deportation program in France, as well as Slovakia, responsible for deporting hundreds of thousands to their death. Ante Pavelić, the head of the mass-murdering Croatian Ustaša regime, responsible for murdering hundreds of thousands of gruesome murders. And then last but not least, Auschwitz Angel of Death, Dr. Joseph Mengele, responsible for conducting medical experiments on live Jewish prisoners. The Church of Jesus Christ, ecclesiastical leaders, bishops, and priests, all had knowledge that the Nazis were rounding up Jews to deport them and murder them. And they chose to remain silent and failed to warn the victims with plenty of opportunity and ability to do so. Pope Pius XI and Pope Pius XII, as well as other Vatican officials and clergy from all around Europe, failed to speak out loudly, openly, and frequently against the murder of innocent people. By the end of the war, an estimated 6 million Jewish men, women, children, infants, and elderly would all be rounded up, deported, and slaughtered, all in the name of Jesus Christ, who we have already assessed was a humanized myth, for God's sakes, just like Romulus or Hercules. The only difference is one of these guys was actually promoted by an emperor, a Roman emperor, that forced it upon millions of others, that turned into a great business deal, as history would present itself. Aside of the four canonical Christian gospels that increasingly became more and more or less tolerant of the Jews, changing their crucifixion stories to affirm the blame on the Sanhedrin, the Jewish elite, and the Jews in the crowd, that it was they who rejected their own God and killed his son Jesus Christ. Literature would continue to be written throughout the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries in the name of apostles that would continue to place the blame on the Jews for the death of Jesus. Even a publication that was supposedly written by Pontius Pilate himself, expressing how hard he tried to let Jesus go free, But the Jewish elite and the Jews just simply wouldn't allow it. He had to die because Jewish law. The Jews chose Jesus to die over the criminal. Right? Barabbas. This type of literature was in mainstream circulation and even read as gospel in many churches. This type of thinking made the events that unfolded in history very easy to do. This would also include intolerance of the LGBTQ community, women's rights, gay marriage, and equality among millions of people. People, this is why it's so important to keep religion out of government and legislature. I can't say it enough. You see what's going on today. History repeats itself. You got to help fight the fight. You got to get out and vote. Right? This message is going out to especially you younger folks. It shows this last election, most of you didn't vote. If you're old enough, get out there and express your opinion. If this podcast has meant anything to you and has moved you in any such way, I deplore you, please get out there and make a difference. Support those who need you. Guys, have a great weekend. It's the 4th of July weekend coming up, and I hope that you're all safe. Have a great time with your families. Hold them close. Cheers.